Chapter 17. Leaving Claudia. Remembering Jenny. A night in the storage shed. The gate. The haunted city. 1. Radar settled into the fleece-lined basket willingly enough, although she had a coughing fit I didn't like. Claudia and I waited until it eased and finally stopped. Claudia used the hem of her dress to wipe the room from Radar's eyes and the sides of her snout, then looked at me gravely.
"Waste no time if you'd save her, Charlie."
I nodded. She pulled me into an embrace, then let go and held me by my shoulders.
"Have a care. I'd be sad to see you back without her, but sadder still not to see you at all. Have you got the instructions I gave you?"
I gave her two thumbs up and patted my back pocket.
"Don't use that gun in the city or even approaching it."
I nodded and put a finger to my lips.
"Shh."
She reached up, tousled my hair, and smiled.
"Fare you well, young Prince Charlie."
I mounted the trike and settled onto the seat. After my bike, it felt like sitting on a tower. I had to put some muscle into the pedals to get going, but once the three-wheeler was rolling, it was easy. I looked around once and waved. Claudia waved back and blew me a kiss. I stopped briefly when I came to the abandoned trolley. One of the wheels had come off and it sat aslant. There were old claw marks on the wooden side nearest me and a dried splash of ancient blood. Wolfies, I thought. I didn't look inside. 2. The going was flat, and I moved along at a good pace. I thought I'd be at the storage shed she told me about well before dark. The sky had closed up again. The land was deserted and shadowless beneath low-hanging clouds. The monarchs had gone to wherever they went in the daytime. I wondered if I'd see them fly back to their roosting places outside the city. The wolves might steer clear of the houses and buildings outside the city wall after dark, but I wouldn't want to bet my life on that. Or Radar's. At mid-morning, I began to pass the first houses and cottages. A little further on, where the first byway intersected Kingdom Road, the hard-packed dirt gave way to a pavement of crushed stone. I would have preferred the hard-pack, all in all, because that was for the most part smooth. There were potholes in the pavement I had to skirt. The tall trike's stability was fine as long as I could ride a straight course, but weaving was tricky. On several swerves, I could feel one of the rear wheels leave the ground. I was able to compensate by leaning into the lift, as I did when turning corners on my bike, but I was pretty sure that even a moderately sharp turn would dump the thing on its side, no matter how much I leaned. I could take a spill. I wasn't sure Radar could. The houses were empty. The windows stared. Crows, not gigantic but mighty big, strutted through run-to-seed front gardens, picking at seeds or any leftover bright thing. There were flowers, but they looked pallid and somehow wrong. Vines, like clutching fingers, crawled up the sides of slumped cottages. I passed a strangely askew building, with crumbling limestone peering through what remained of the plaster facing. Swinging doors hung ajar, making the entrance look like a dead mouth. On the lintel above them was a stein, so faded that the painted beer inside looked like piss. Written above the stein in faded, straggling maroon letters was the word, "Beware." Next to it was what had once probably been a store of some kind. A shatter of glass lay on the road in front. Mindful of the three-wheeler's rubber tires, I gave the broken glass a wide berth. A bit further on, there were buildings on both sides now, standing almost shoulder to shoulder but with dark little passages between, we passed through a stink so strong and sewerish that it made me gag and hold my breath. Radar didn't like it either. She whined uneasily and stirred, making the three-wheeler rock a little. I'd been thinking about stopping for something to eat, But that stench changed my mind. It wasn't decaying flesh, but it was something that had spoiled in some holy and perhaps unholy way. An herbage rank and wild, I thought. And that line brought back memories of Jenny Schuster. Sitting with her under a tree, the two of us leaning against the trunk in the dappled shade, her wearing the tattered old vest that was her trademark, and holding a paperback book in her lap. It was called The Best of H.P. Lovecraft, and she was reading me a poem called Fungi from Yugoth. I remembered how it began. The place was dark and dusty and half lost in tangles of old alleys near the quays. And suddenly, the reason why this place was freaking me out came into focus. I was still miles from Lillimar, what that refugee boy had called the haunted city. But even here, things were wrong, in ways I don't think I could have consciously understood if not for Jenny, who introduced me to Lovecraft when both of us were sixth graders, too young and impressionable for such horrors. Jenny and I became book buddies during my father's last year of drinking and first year of sobriety. She was a girlfriend as opposed to a girlfriend, which means something entirely different. "I'll never understand why you want to hang with her," Bertie said once. I think he was jealous, but I think he was also honestly perplexed. "Do you, like, make out with her? Suck face, swap spits?" We did not, and I told him so. I said she didn't interest me in that way. Bertie smirked and said, "What other way is there?" I could have told him, but that would have perplexed him more than ever. It was true that Jenny didn't have what the Birdman would have called the kind of bod you want to explore. At 11 or 12, most girls are showing the first faint curves, but Jenny was as flat as a board in front and straight all the way down. She had a raw-boned face, mousy brown hair that was always in a tangle, and a storky way of walking. The other girls made fun of her, of course. She was never going to be a cheerleader or homecoming queen or star in a class play. And if she wanted such things, or the approval of the girls who mixed and matched and wore eyeshadow, she never showed it. I'm not sure she ever felt so much as an ounce of peer pressure. She didn't dress goth, wore jumpers with that funky vest on top and carried a Han Solo lunchbox to school, but she had a goth mentality. She worshipped a punk band called the Dead Kennedys, could quote lines from Taxi Driver, and loved the stories and poems of H.P. Lovecraft. She and I and H.P.L. connected toward the end of my dark period, when I was still getting up to stupid shit with Bertie Bird. One day, in sixth grade English class, the discussion turned to the works of R.L. Stein. I had read one of his books, Can You Keep a Secret, it was called, and thought it was mondo stupid. I said so, then said I'd like to read something that was really scary instead of fake scary. Jenny caught up with me after class. "Hey, read. Are you afraid of big words?" I said I was not. I said if I couldn't figure out a word from the story, I looked it up on my phone. That seemed to please her. "Read this," she said, and handed me a battered paperback held together with scotch tape. "See if it scares you, because it scared the living shit out of me." That book was called The Call of Cthulhu, and the stories in it scared me plenty, especially one called The Rats in the Walls. There were also lots of big words to look up, like tenebrous and malodorous, which was the perfect word for what I smelled near that bar. We bonded over horror, possibly because we were the only sixth graders who were willing to wade, and gladly, through the thickets of Lovecraft's prose. For over a year, until Jenny's parents broke up and she moved to Des Moines with her mother, we read the stories and poems to each other aloud. We also saw a couple of movies made out of his stories, but they sucked. None of them got how big that guy's imagination was, and how fucking dark. As I pedaled my way toward the walled city of Lillimar, I realized this silent outer ring was too much like one of HPL's dark fairy tales of Arkham and Dunwich. Put in the context of that and other tales of otherworldly terror, we moved on to Clark Ashton Smith, Henry Kuttner, and August Derleth. I was able to understand what was so frightening and strangely disheartening about the empty streets and houses. To use one of Lovecraft's favorite words, they were eldritch. A stone bridge took us over a dead canal. Large rats prowled through garbage so ancient there was no telling what it had been before it became garbage. The canal's slanting stone sides were streaked with blackish-brown crap, what Lovecraft would undoubtedly have called ordure. And the stink rising from the cracked black mud? He would have called it mephitic. Those words came back to me. This place brought them back. On the other side of the canal, the buildings crowded even closer together, the spaces between them not alleys or passages, but mere cracks a person would have to sidle through. And who knew what might be lurking in there, waiting for the sidler? These empty edifices overhung the street, seeming to bulge toward the trike, and covering all but a zigzag of white sky. I felt watched, not just from those black and glassless windows, but by them, which was even worse. Something terrible had happened here. I was sure of it. Something monstrous, and yes, eldritch. The source of the gray might still be ahead in the city, but it was strong even out here in these deserted environs. Besides feeling watched, there was a crepitant sensation of being followed. Several times I snapped my head around, trying to catch someone or something, some frightful fiend, slipping along in our wake. I saw nothing but crows and the occasional rat, possibly headed back to its nesting place or colony in the shadows of that mud-floored canal. Radar felt it too. She growled several times, and once when I looked around, I saw her sitting up with her paws on the end of the wicker basket and looking back the way we had come. Nothing, I thought. These narrow streets and tumble-down houses are deserted. You've just got the heebie-jeebies. Radar, too. We came to another bridge over another desolate canal, and on one of its pillars, I saw something that cheered me up. The initials A.B. Not quite covered by incrustations of sickly yellow-green moss. The crowded buildings had caused me to lose sight of the city wall for an hour or two, but on the bridge, I could see it clearly, smooth and gray and at least 40 feet high. In the center was a titanic gate, crisscrossed with thick supports of what looked like cloudy green glass. The wall and gate were visible, because most of the buildings between where I stood and the city wall had been reduced to rubble by what looked like a bombing attack. Some sort of cataclysm, anyway. A few charred chimneys stood up like pointing fingers, and a few buildings had been spared. One looked like a church. Another was a long building with wooden sides and a tin roof. In front of it was a wheelless red wagon engulfed in pale weeds. I had heard the two bells signaling midday, chow time for Hannah, I thought, less than 2 hours ago, which meant I'd made much better time than Claudia had expected. There was plenty of daylight left, but I had no intention of approaching the gate today. I needed to rest and get my head on straight, if that were possible.
I think we're here,
I told Radar.
It's not the Holiday Inn, but it'll do.
I pedaled past the abandoned wagon and up to the storage shed. There was a big roll-up door, its once jolly red faded to a sickly pink, and a smaller, man-sized door beside it. Chipped into the paint were the initials A.B. Seeing them made me feel good, just as the ones on the bridge pillar had, but there was something else that made me feel even better. That sense of creeping doom had lifted. Maybe it was because the buildings were gone and I could feel space around me and see the sky again, but I don't think that was all. That sense of what Lovecraft might have called ancient evil was gone. Later, not too long after the three evening bells, I discovered why. 3. The man-sized door wouldn't open until I really put my shoulder into it, then burst open so suddenly I almost fell inside. Radar barked from her basket. The storage shed was gloomy and smelled stale, but not mephitic or odorous. Bulking in the gloom were two more trolleys painted red and blue. They had undoubtedly been in the shed for years, but because they were out of the elements, the paint had stayed fresh and they looked almost cheerful. Poles jutted from their roofs, so I guessed at some time or other they must have run on overhead wires that provided current. If so, those wires were long gone. I had seen none on my journey. On the front of one, in old-fashioned letters, was the word Seafront. Over the other, Lillimar. There were stacks of iron-bound wheels with thick wooden spokes and boxes of rusty tools. I also saw a line of torpedo-shaped lamps on a table that stood against the far wall. Radar barked again. I went back and lifted her out of the basket. She staggered a little, then limped to the door. She sniffed and went inside without any further hesitation. I tried the big roll-up door, the ones the trolleys must have used, but it wouldn't budge. I left the smaller one open for light and checked the lamps. It looked like it was going to be a dark night for Prince Charlie and his faithful sidekick Radar, because the oil in their reservoirs was long gone. And Claudia's three-wheeler would have to spend the night outside because the smaller door was too narrow for it. The wooden spokes of the spare trolley wheels were dry and splintery. I knew I could break off enough wood for a fire, and I had brought the Zippo my dad used to light his pipe, but no way was I going to build a campfire inside. It was too easy to imagine sparks landing on the old trolleys and lighting them up, leaving us with no refuge but the church-type building, which looked rickety. I got out a couple of cans of sardines and some of the meat Dora had packed for me. I ate and drank a Coke. Radar refused the meat, tried a sardine, then dropped it on the dusty wooden floor. She had been happy with Dora's molasses cookies before, so I tried that. She sniffed, then turned her head away. Perky jerky was also a no-go. I stroked the sides of her face. What am I going to do with you, girl? Fix her, I thought. If I can. I started for the door, wanting another look at the wall surrounding the city, then had an inspiration. I went back to my pack, rummaged, and found the last few pecan sandies in a baggie underneath my useless iPhone. I offered her one. She sniffed it carefully, took it in her mouth, and ate it, plus three more before turning away. Better than nothing. 4. I watched the light through the open door and occasionally went out to look around. All was still. Even the rats and crows were avoiding this part of town. I tried tossing Raids her monkey. She caught it once and gave it a few token squeaks, but didn't try bringing it back to me. She laid it between her paws and went to sleep with her nose touching it. Claudia's liniment had helped her, but the effects had worn off, and she wouldn't take the last three pills the vet's assistant had given me. I thought she had used up her last real burst of energy, running down the spiral steps and racing to meet Dora. If I didn't get her to the sundial soon, I'd find her not asleep, but dead. I would have played games on my phone to pass the time if it worked, but it was just a black glass rectangle. I tried restarting it, but didn't even get the apple. There was no fairy tale magic in the world I had come from, and no magic from my world in this one. I put it back in my pack and watched the open doorway as the white overcast light began to weaken. The three evening bells donged, and I almost closed the door then, but I didn't want to be in the dark with nothing but Dad's lighter to knock it back until I had to. I kept my eye on the church, if that's what it was, across the road and thought when I could no longer see it, I'd shut the door. The absence of birds and rats didn't necessarily mean the absence of wolves or other predators. Claudia had told me to bolt myself in, and that was just what I intended to do. When the church was just a dim shape in a darkening world, I decided to pull the door shut. Radar raised her head, perked her ears, and gave a low woof. I thought it was because I'd gotten up, but that wasn't it. Old or not, her ears were better than mine. I heard it a few seconds later. A low, fluttering sound, like paper caught in a fan. It approached rapidly, growing in volume until it was the sound of a rising wind. I knew what it was. And as I stood in the doorway with one hand on the three-wheeler's seat, Radar joined me. We both watched the sky. The monarchs came from the direction I had arbitrarily decided was the south, the direction I'd come from. They darkened the darkening sky in a cloud below the clouds. They settled on the church-type building across the way, on a few standing chimneys, on piles of rubble, and on the roof of the storage shed where Radar and I had taken shelter. The sound of them settling up there, there must have been thousands, was less a fluttering than a long, drawn-out sigh. Now I thought I understood why this part of the bombed-out wasteland seemed safe to me, rather than desolate. It was safe. The monarchs had kept this one outpost in a world that had once been better, one that existed before the members of the royal family had been either assassinated or driven out. In my world, I believed, and I wasn't alone, all that royalty business was so much bullshit. Fodder for supermarket tabloids like the National Enquirer and Inside View. Kings and queens, princes and princesses were just another family, but one that had lucked into all the right numbers in the genetic version of Mega Millions. They took down their britches when they had to shit, just like the lowliest peons. But this wasn't that world. This was Empus, where the rules were different. This really was the other. The cloud of monarch butterflies had finished their homecoming, leaving only the growing dark. The sigh of their wings faded away. I would bolt the door because Claudia had told me to, but I felt safe, protected. "Hail, Empus," I said softly. "Hail the Galleon, and may they rule again and forever." And why not? Just why the fuck not? Anything would be better than this desolation. I closed the door and bolted it. 5. In the dark, there was nothing to do but go to sleep. I put my pack between the two trolleys, next to where Radar had curled up, laid my head on it, and was asleep almost at once. My last thought was that with no alarm to wake me up, I might oversleep and get a late start, which could be lethal. I needn't have worried. Radar woke me up, coughing and coughing. I gave her some water, and that eased it a little. I had no clock but my bladder, which was pretty full but not bursting. I thought about urinating in one of the corners, then decided that was no way to treat a safe haven. I unbolted the door, opened it a little way, and peered out. No stars or moonlight showed through the low-hanging clouds. The church across the road looked blurry to me. I rubbed my eyes to clarify my vision, but the blur remained. It wasn't in my eyes. It was the butterflies, still fast asleep. I didn't think they lived long in our world, only weeks or months. Over here, who knew? Something shifted at the very edge of my vision. I looked, but either it had been my imagination, or whatever had been there was gone. I pissed, looking over my shoulder as I did it, then went back inside. I bolted the door and made my way to Radar. There was no need to use Dad's lighter. Her breathing was hoarse and loud. I drifted off to sleep again, maybe for an hour or so, maybe for two. I dreamed that I was in my own bed on Sycamore Street. I sat up, tried to yawn, and couldn't. My mouth was gone. That snapped me awake to more canine coughing. One of Radar's eyes was open, but the other was stuck shut with that gooey stuff, giving her a sadly piratical look. I wiped it away and went to the door. The monarchs were still roosting, but a little light had come into the dull sky. It was time to eat something, then get going. I held an open can of sardines under Radar's nose, but she turned her head away at once, as if the smell sickened her. There were two pecan sandies left. She ate one, tried to eat the other, and coughed it out. She looked at me. I took her face in my hands and moved it gently from side to side in a way I knew she liked. I felt like crying. "Hold on, girl. Okay? Please." I carried her out the door and set her carefully on her feet. She walked to the left of the door with the glassy care of the elderly, found the spot where I had pissed earlier and added hers to mine. I bent to pick her up again, but she circled around me and went to the right-hand rear wheel of Claudia's trike, the one closest to the road. She sniffed at it, then dropped her haunches and pissed again. She gave a low, growling sound as she did it. I went to the rear wheel and bent down. There was nothing to see, but I felt sure that whatever I'd caught a glimpse of earlier had approached after I went back inside. Not only approached, but pissed on my ride, as if to say, "This is my territory." I had my pack, but I decided there was something else I wanted. I went back inside. Raid sat watching me. I hunted around until I found a moldering stack of blankets in the corner, perhaps meant long ago for trolley passengers to bundle around themselves in cold weather. If I hadn't decided to do my business outside, I might have pissed on them in the dark. I took one and shook it out. A number of dead moths fluttered down to the shed floor like big snowflakes. I folded it into a pad and carried it out to the three-wheeler.
"Okay, Raids, let's get this done. What do you say?"
I lifted her into the basket and then tucked the folded blanket down beside her. Claudia had instructed me to wait until the first bell before leaving, but with the monarchs roosting all around, I felt safe enough. I mounted up and started pedaling slowly toward the gate in the wall. After half an hour or so, the morning bell sounded. This close to the city, it was very loud. The monarchs rose in a great wave of black and gold, heading south. I watched them go, wishing I were going that way myself, to Dora's, then to the tunnel entrance, then back into my own world of computers and magic steel birds that flew in the air. But, just as the poem says, I had miles to go and promises to keep. "At least the night soldiers are gone," I thought. "Back to their crypts and mausoleums, because that's where things like them sleep." There was no way I could know that for sure, but I did. 6. We reached the gate in less than an hour. I'd dismounted the trike. Overhead, the clouds were lower and darker than ever, and I didn't think the rain could hold off for much longer. My estimate that the gray wall was 40 feet high turned out to be way wrong. It was 70, at least, and the gate was titanic. It was faced in gold, real gold, I was sure, not paint, and almost as long as a football field. The staves bracing it leaned this way and that, but not from age and decay. I was sure they had been placed that way, making strange angles. They made me think of Lovecraft again, and the mad non-Euclidean universe of monsters that was always straining to overwhelm ours. It wasn't just the angles that were disturbing. Those staves were of some cloudy green substance that looked like a kind of metallic glass. Something seemed to be moving in them, like black vapor. It made my stomach feel funny. I looked away, and when I looked back, the black stuff was gone. When I turned my head and looked at the staves from the corner of my eye, the black stuff seemed to return. Vertigo swept through me. Not wanting to lose what little breakfast I'd eaten, I looked down at my feet. And there, on one of the cobblestones, printed in paint that might once have been blue but had faded to gray, were the initials A.B. My head cleared, and when I looked up, I just saw the gate, crisscrossed by those green supports. But what a gate it was, like a CGI effect out of an epic movie. But this was no special effect. I wrapped my knuckles on one of the cloudy green staves, just to be sure. I wondered what would happen if I tried Claudia's name on the gate, or Stephen Woodley's. They were both of the royal blood, weren't they? The answer was yes, but if I understood correctly, I wasn't sure I did because I've never been good at untangling familial relationships, only Princess Leia was the heir apparent to the throne of Empis. Or maybe it was the throne of the Galleons. It didn't matter to me, as long as I could get in. If the name didn't work, I was going to be stuck out here, and Radar would die. Stupid Charlie actually looked for an intercom, the sort of thing you'd find beside the doorway of an apartment building. There was no such thing, of course, just those weird crisscrossing staves with impenetrable blackness between them. I muttered, "Leia of the Galleon." Nothing happened. Not loud enough, maybe, I thought. But shouting seemed wrong in the silence outside the wall, almost like spitting on a church altar. Do it anyway. Outside the city, it's probably safe enough. Do it for Radar. In the end, I couldn't bring myself to shout, but I cleared my throat and raised my voice. Open in the name of Leia of the Galleon. I was answered by an inhuman scream that made me step back and almost fall over the front of the trike. You know that saying, my heart was in my mouth? Mine felt like it was ready to bolt out from between my lips, run away, and leave me dead on the ground. The screaming went on, and I realized it was the sound of some titanic machine starting up after years or decades. Perhaps not since Mr. Bowditch had last used this world's version of Open Sesame. The gate trembled. I saw those black tendrils writhing and rising in the off-kilter green staves. There was no doubt about them this time. It was like looking at sediment in a shaken bottle. The screech of the machinery changed to a rattling thunder, and the gate started to move to the left, along what must have been a huge hidden track. I watched it slide by, and the vertigo returned, worse than ever. I turned away, drunk staggered 4 steps to the seat of Claudia's trike, and put my face down on it. My heart was slamming in my chest, my neck, even in the sides of my face. I couldn't look at those ever-changing angles as the gate opened. I thought I'd pass out if I did, or see something so awful it would send me fleeing back the way I'd come, leaving my dying dog behind. I closed my eyes and reached out for a handful of her fur. Hold on, I thought. Hold on, hold on, hold on. 7. At last, the clattering rumble stopped. There was another of those protesting screeches, and silence returned. Returned? It fell, like an anvil. I opened my eyes and saw Radar looking at me. I opened my hand and saw I'd pulled out a considerable swatch of her hair, but she hadn't complained. Maybe because she had greater pains to contend with, but I don't think that was it. I think she realized I needed her. Okay, I said. Let's see what we've got. Ahead of me, inside the gate, was a vast tiled courtyard. It was lined with the remains of great stone butterflies on both sides, each on a pedestal and standing 20 feet high. Their wings had been broken and lay in piles on the courtyard floor. They made a kind of passageway. I wondered if, once upon a better time, each of those monarch butterflies, for of course that was what they were, had represented a king or queen in the line of Galleon. The screaming started up again, and I realized the gate was preparing to roll shut. Leah's name might open it again, it might not. I had no intention of finding out. I mounted up and pedaled inside as the gate began to rumble shut. The rubber wheels whispered on the tiles, which had once been colorful but were now faded. Everything turning gray, I thought. Gray or that sick shade of cloudy green. The butterflies, perhaps once colorful but now as gray as everything else, loomed over us as we passed beneath and between. Their bodies were intact, but the faces, as well as the wings, had been battered off. It made me think of videos I'd seen of ISIS destroying ancient statues, artifacts, and temples they considered blasphemous. We came to a double arch in the shape of butterfly wings. Something had been written above it, but that too had been battered. All that remained were the letters L-I. My first thought was Lillimar, the name of the city, but it could have been Galleon. Before going through the arch, I looked back to check on radar. We had to be quiet. Each of the people I'd met made that point in his or her own way, and I didn't think that was going to be a problem with raids. She was asleep again. Which was good in one way, and worrisome in another. The arch was damp and smelled of ancient decay. On the other side was a circular pool faced in lichen-encrusted stone. Perhaps once the water in that pool had been a cheerful blue. Perhaps once people had come here to sit on its stone coping, eating their midday meals while watching the empessarian version of ducks or swans go gliding. Mothers might have held their children out so they could paddle their feet. Now there were no birds and no people. If there had been, they would have steered clear of that pool as if it were poison, because that's what it looked like. The water was an opaque, viscous green that appeared almost solid. The vapor arising from it was indeed mephitic, what I imagined the stench of a tomb stuffed with decaying bodies would smell like. Surrounding it was a curving walkway, just barely big enough for the three-wheeler. On one of the tiles, to the right, were Mr. Bowditch's initials. I started that way, then stopped and looked back, certain I'd heard something. The shuffle of a footstep, or maybe the whisper of a voice. "Pay no mind to voices you may hear," Claudia had said. Now I heard nothing, and nothing moved in the shadows of the arch I'd come through. I pedaled slowly along the right side curve of the stinking pool. On the far side was another butterfly arch. As I neared it, a drop of rain fell on the back of my neck. Then another. They began to dot the pool, making brief craters on its surface. As I looked, something black emerged from it just for a second or two, then it disappeared. I didn't get a good look, but I'm pretty sure I saw the momentary gleam of teeth. The rain began to come down harder. Soon it would be a torrent. Once in the shelter of the second arch, I dismounted and spread the blanket over my sleeping dog. Musty and moth-eaten or not, I was very glad I'd brought it. 8. Because I was ahead of schedule, I hoped that I could linger for a while in the shelter of this arch, hoping the rain would let up. I didn't want to take raids out in it, even with the blanket to cover her. Only how long was a while? 15 minutes? 20? And just how was I supposed to tell? I'd become used to checking my phone for the time, and wished bitterly for Mr. Bowditch's watch. It came to me as I stared at the rain sheeting down on what looked like a deserted business street crammed with green-fronted shops, that I had become too used to my phone, period. My dad had a saying about computer-driven gear.
Let a man get used to walking on a crutch and he can't walk without it.
The shops were on the far side of a dry channel. They looked to be the sort of places well-to-do people would visit, like an antique version of Rodeo Drive or the Oak Street District in Chicago. From where I was, I could read one gold-plated, surely not solid gold, sign that read, His Majesty's Bootery. There were show windows from which the glass had been broken long ago. Many rains had driven the shards into the gutters, and in the middle of the street, curled like the body of a never-ending snake, was what had to be a trolley wire. Something had been engraved on the paving just outside the arch where we were sheltering. I got on my knees for a close look. Most of it had been battered away like the wings and faces of the butterflies, but when I ran my fingers over the beginning and the end, I thought I could make out G-A and A-D. The letters between might have been anything, but I thought maybe this main thoroughfare, which had been Kingdom Road outside the wall, became Galleon Road inside. Whatever it was, it led straight toward the high buildings and green towers of the central city. Three spires stood higher than the rest, their glassy pinnacles disappearing into the clouds. I didn't know it was the Royal Palace, any more than I knew the remains of the letters had once spelled out Galleon Road, but I thought it was very likely. Just when I began to think we'd have to push on and get drenched, the rain let up a little. I checked to make sure radar was covered, nothing sticking out of the blanket but the end of her snout and her back paws, then mounted up and pedaled slowly across the dry channel. As we did, I wondered if I was crossing the Rumpa Bridge Woody had told me about. 9. The shops were fancy, but something was wrong about them. It wasn't just that they were deserted or obvious that at some time in the distant past they had been looted, perhaps by Lillimar residents fleeing their city when the Grey came. There was something else that was more subtle and more awful because it was still there, still happening. The buildings seemed solid enough, vandalized or not, but they were twisted somehow, as if a gigantic force had pulled them out of shape and they hadn't been able to entirely snap back. When I looked directly at them, His Majesty's Bootery, Culinary Delights, Curious Treasures, Tailors to the House of... The rest of that one had been beaten away, as if what followed were profane. Spokes and wheels. They seemed okay. Normal enough, if anything could be said to be normal in the otherworldliness of the other. But when I returned to minding my straight path down the wide street, something happened to them at the edge of my vision. Straight angles seemed to slither into curves. Glassless windows seemed to move like eyes squinting for a better look at me. Letters became runes. I told myself this was nothing but my hopped-up imagination, but I couldn't be sure. One thing I was sure of, I didn't want to be here after dark. At one cross street, a huge stone gargoyle had tumbled into the street and stared at me upside down, with its lipless mouth stretched open to show a pair of reptilian fangs and a pitted gray tongue. I made a wide arc around it, relieved to get past its chilly upside-down gaze. As I moved on, there was a low thud. I looked back and saw the gargoyle had fallen over. Maybe one of the back wheels of the trike had brushed it, upsetting the precarious balance it had maintained for years? Maybe not. Either way, it was staring at me again. 10. The palace, assuming that was what it was, grew closer. The buildings on either side looked like townhouses, once no doubt luxurious, but now falling to ruin. Balconies had collapsed. Carriage lamps marking fancy stone walks had either fallen over or been knocked down. The walks themselves were sprouting brownish-gray weeds that looked nasty. The spaces between these stone houses had been choked with nettles. Going through would tear your skin to ribbons. The rain started to come down heavily again as we reached even fancier houses, these constructed of marble and glass, with wide steps intact, and fancy porticos, mostly smashed. I told Radar to hang in there, we had to be getting close, but I did it in a low voice. In spite of the downpour, my mouth was dry. I never even considered turning it up to catch some rain because I didn't know what might be in it or what it would do to me. This was a terrible place. An infection had run through it, and I didn't want to drink any of it down. Yet it seemed to me there was one good thing. Claudia had told me I might get lost, but so far it had been a straight shot. If Hannah's yellow house and the sundial were near the majestic agglomeration of buildings overlooked by the three spires, Galleon Road would take me directly there. Now I could see vast windows in that great pile. They weren't stained glass like those in a cathedral, but a shimmering, deep green that reminded me of the staves in the outer gate and that nasty pool. Looking at them, I almost missed Mr. Bowditch's initials, painted halfway up a stone post with a ring bolt on top, presumably for hitching horses. There was a row of these, like blunt teeth, standing in front of a gigantic gray building with almost a dozen doors at the top of its steep steps, but not a single window. The post bearing the initials AB was the last in line before a narrower street branching off to the left. The crossbar of the letter A had been turned into an arrow that pointed down this narrow way, which was lined with more faceless stone buildings, hulking 8 or 10 stories high. I could imagine that once these had been filled with empressarian bureaucrats doing the work of the kingdom. I could almost see them scurrying in and out, wearing long black frock coats and shirts with high collars, like men, I guess they would all be men, in the illustrations of a Dickens novel. I didn't know if any of the buildings housed His Majesty's royal prison, but in a way they all looked like prisons to me. I stopped, staring at the A crossbar that had been turned into an arrow. The palace was dead ahead, but the arrow was pointing me away from it. The question was this: did I keep on going straight, or did I follow the arrow? From behind me, in the basket and under a blanket that was now wet and would soon be soaking, Radar had another coughing fit. I almost disregarded the arrow and went straight on, figuring I could always come back if I ran into a dead end or something. But then I remembered two things Claudia had told me. One was that if I followed Mr. Bowditch's marks, all would be well. Might be well is what she actually said, but why quibble? The other was that I had, according to her, a goddamned long trek ahead of me. But if I continued the way I was going, it would be a goddamned short trek. In the end, I decided to trust Claudia and Mr. Bowditch. I turned the trike in the direction the arrow pointed and pedaled on. "The streets are a maze," Claudia told me. She was right about that. And Mr. Bowditch's initials, his marks, took me ever deeper into it. New York made sense. Chicago made a degree of sense. Lillimar made no sense at all. I imagined it was the way London must have been during the time of Sherlock Holmes and Jack the Ripper. For all I know, it's that way now. Some of the streets were wide and lined with leafless trees that gave no shelter from the rain. Some were narrow, one so skinny that the three-wheeler barely fit. On that one, we got some relief from the pelting rain, at least, because double-decker buildings hung over the street, almost touching. Sometimes there were trolley wires, a few still hanging down in tensionless swags, most lying in the street. In one window I saw a headless dressmaker's dummy with a jester's cap and bells on its neck and a knife planted between its breasts. If that was someone's idea of a joke, it wasn't funny. After the first hour, I had no idea how many rights and lefts I'd taken. At one point, I went through a dripping underpass where the sound of the trike's wheels splashing through standing water sent back echoes that sounded like whispered laughter. Some of his marks, the ones out in the weather, were so faded they were hard to see. If I lost the trail they made, I'd have to retrace my course or try to take a bearing from the three spires of what I assumed was the palace, and I didn't know if I could do that. For long stretches, the buildings crowding in on me blotted it out entirely. It was all too easy to imagine myself blundering through this snarl of streets until the two bells, and then the evening three, and then having to worry about the night soldiers. Only in this rain, and with the steady coughing from behind me, I thought by nightfall radar would be dead. Twice I passed gaping holes that slanted down into darkness. From these there wafted drafts of ill-smelling air, and what sounded like those whispering voices Claudia had warned me about. The smell from the second one was stronger, the whispering louder. I didn't want to imagine terrified city dwellers taking refuge in vast underground bunkers and dying there, but it was hard not to. Impossible, really. Just as it was impossible to believe those whispering voices were anything but the voices of their ghosts. I didn't want to be here. I wanted to be home in my sane world, where the only disembodied voices came out of my earpods. I came to a corner with what might have been Mr. Bowditch's initials on a lamppost, or just a swatch of old blood. I got off the three-wheeler for a closer look. Yes, it was his mark, but almost gone. I didn't dare wipe the water and grime from it for fear of erasing it entirely, so I bent until my nose was almost touching it. The crossbar of the A pointed right, I was sure of it. Almost sure. As I went back to the trike, Radar poked her head out of the blanket and whined. One of her eyes was glued shut with ooze. The other was at half-mast but looking behind us. I looked that way and heard a footstep, for sure, this time, and caught a flash of movement that could have been a bit of clothing, a cloak, maybe, as its wearer stepped around another corner a few streets back. "Who's there?" I called, then clapped my hands over my mouth. Quiet, be quiet. Everyone I'd met had told me that. In a much lower voice, almost a shouted whisper, I added, "Show yourself. If you're a friend, I can be a friend." No one showed himself. I hadn't really expected them to. I dropped my hand to the butt of Mr. Bowditch's revolver. "If you're not, I have a gun and I'll use it if I have to." Pure bluff. I'd been warned about that, too, and strongly. "Do you hear me? For your sake, stranger, I hope you do." I didn't exactly sound like myself, and not for the first time. I sounded more like a character in a book or a movie. I almost expected to hear myself say, "My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." Radar was coughing again, and she had started to shiver. I got back on the trike and pedaled in the direction the latest arrow pointed. It led me onto a zigzagging street, paved with cobblestones, and for some reason lined with barrels, many of them overturned. 11. I continued to follow the initials. a few almost as bright as the day he put them there in red paint, most faded to ghosts of their former selves. Left and right, right and left. I saw no bodies or skeletons of the long departed, but I smelled rot almost everywhere, and occasionally there was that sense of the building slyly changing their shapes. I rode through puddles in places. In others, the streets had flooded completely, and the trike's big wheels ran through the murk almost hubcap deep. The rain diminished to a drizzle, then stopped. I had no clue as to how far I was from Hannah's yellow house. With no phone to consult and no sun in the sky, my sense of time was completely fucked. I kept expecting the 2 midday bells to ring out.
Lost, I thought. I am lost. I have no GPS, and I'll never get there in time. I'll be lucky to get out of this crazy place before dark.
Then I crossed a little square with a statue in the middle. It was of a woman with her head swatted off, and realized I could see the 3 spires again. Only now I was looking at them from the side. I had an idea then, and it came to me, absurd but true, in the voice of Coach Harkness, who coached basketball as well as baseball. Coach Harkness striding up and down the sidelines, red in the face, and with big patches of sweat showing at the armpits of the white shirt he always wore on game nights, following the flow of his team and screaming,
back door, damn it!
Back door. That was where Mr. Bowditch's trail of initials was leading me, not to the front of that enormous central building, where Galleon Road no doubt ended, but behind it. I crossed the square to the left, expecting to find his initials on one of the 3 streets leading away from it, and so I did, painted on the side of a shattered glass building that might once have been a greenhouse of some kind. Now the side of the palace was on my right, and, yes, the marks led me further and further around. I began to see a high, curving shoulder of stonework behind the sprawl of the main buildings. I pedaled faster. The next mark pointed me to the right, along what must have been, in better days, a wide boulevard. Back then, it might have been fancy-schmancy, but now the pavement was cracked and crumbled away to gravel in some places. An overgrown median ran down the center. Among the weeds were enormous flowers with yellow petals and deep green centers. I slowed long enough to look at one that overhung the street on its long stem, but when I reached toward it, the petals closed with a snap, inches from my fingers. Some white, sappy fluid drooled out. I could feel heat. I pulled my hand back in a hurry. Further along, maybe a quarter of a mile, I saw 3 looming roof peaks, one on either side of the boulevard I was now traveling, and one that appeared to be right over it. They were the same yellow as the hungry flowers. Directly ahead of me, the boulevard debouched into another square with a dry fountain in the center of it. It was huge and green, with random obsidian cracks running through its bowl.
"Write it down, Prince Charlie,"
had been Claudia's constant scripture, and I checked the notes I'd taken just to be sure. Dry fountain, check. Huge yellow house straddling the road, check. Hide, double check. I stuffed the sheet of paper into the side pocket of my pack to keep it from getting wet. Didn't even think about it at the time, but later on I had reason to be grateful it was in there instead of my pocket. Ditto my phone. I rode slowly to the square, then more quickly to the fountain. Its pedestal was easily 8 feet high and as thick as a tree trunk. Good cover. I dismounted and peeked around the pedestal. Ahead of me, no more than 50 yards from the fountain, was Hannah's house. Or houses. They were connected by a yellow-painted corridor over the central passageway, sort of like the skyways you see all over Minneapolis. Quite the abode, all in all. And Hannah was outside.